Welcome to The Collection. On this week's show, Ruth Lee from Arbuthnot Banking Group.
I think it's fair, going through the marriage analogy, that you've seen your spouse change from a sort of cuddly, hands-off, whatever it was, person to somebody who actually interferes with every aspect of your life.
Market commentator Bill Hubbard.
You either go too high or too low. Right now, they're going too low. You know as well as I do why are there always jobs in the city? Because when it gets bad, everybody gets hired.
And Zaf Karim, CEO of Legendary Investments.
In these turbulent times, there are always opportunities. You can make fortunes.
Already smug homeowning Londoners had the chance to crack open the champagne once again, as it was revealed that the average home in the capital costs more than £500 million in more than half of its postcodes. Clearly, this rich part of the UK population did not follow the periodic advice of Bank of England Governor Mark Carney and the bum steers regarding interest rates going up. The point has been underlined by the way that Fidelity's Dominic Rossi declared himself to be less than impressed by the forward guidance of our unreliable boyfriend central banker. Clearly, the global chief investment officer has not been told that it is in the nature of boyfriends to be somewhat difficult to read, even at the best of times. That said, Mr. Carney was helpful in the great Brexit debate in terms of giving us an idea of what would happen if the UK left the EU, especially so with the issue of the current account deficit. In this area, we are told it is the kindness of strangers or hot money from abroad which saves the day. Brexit could mean this dries up, and according to Goldman Sachs, sterling falls by as much as 20%. Of course, during the week, Captain Mannering, or Neville Chamberlain, or David Cameron as he is more commonly known, has been attempting to appease the evil EU empire. Unfortunately, on this occasion, we have not even seen a scrap of paper fluttering in the breeze on his return. The stay camp looks as though it has its challenges, as much on the EU as with the Conservative Party dividing in two ahead of a likely June referendum.
We don't want to have our country bound up in an ever closer political union in Europe. We are a proud and independent nation with proud, independent, democratic institutions that have served us well over the centuries. For us, Europe is about working together to advance our shared prosperity and our shared security. It's not about being sucked into some kind of European superstate. Not now, not ever.
Bill, as an American,
yes.
What's your view on all of this?
Well, let's go back probably before. I have been against the whole concept since 1957. I was against the European coal and steel community when it was just Germany and France and three little dwarfs. Well, I said even then, they didn't have a clue. And I've even gotten even more anti, and that's even after having a house in Spain for 6 years. I mean, it was just a situation where they needed us, and I don't care what anybody else says, they needed us far more than we need them.
All right, but I think, you know, obviously not all of us can remember 1957, but we were coming off the back of, you know, Second World War, a couple of wars in the 20th century. There were some quite compelling ideas for countries, to gather
the
together.
The reason for this was the simple fact is that France and Germany agreed, because after twice being invaded, mostly over minerals, coal, etc., etc., that France and Germany sat down and says, if we give you X, Y, and Z, we'll set it up as a free trade zone for coal and steel, okay? And as I say, Belgium, the Netherlands, and one other country.
Italy,
okay, all agreed to it. And that's what it was set up for, okay? Basically, a setup to have a free trade zone between these 2/5 countries over steel and coal, hopefully to prevent World War III.
Okay, that's great. So that actually takes us from not being a little alliance of countries, but actually an economic pact. And that's where it's a good idea, I think, to speak to an economist.
Yes.
Ruth Lee, you have been also against the idea of the EU for a long time or not?
Well, I think the first thing is that from the European steel and coal community, or coal and steel community, should I say, then of course you had the Rome Treaty in 1958 and you had the beginnings of the European Economic Community. And the Rome Treaty talked about the ever closer union of the peoples of Europe. And let's be clear about that. That was about political union as well as economic union. However, when it got to the 70s, I'd started my career in the civil service and I was told that this country was such a basket case. I was starting my career and I was told the country was a basket case. And indeed, it looked like that at the time because we were very strike-prone, bloody, bloody, bloody. We'd lost an empire, not yet found a role, all those things. And the morale in this country was absolutely dreadful. And we were told, actually, as civil servants, that you're here to manage decline. Now, isn't that
really
terrific? We were told that, essentially. And when it came to the European Community's white paper, and I remember it very well in 1972, then this was seen as a way out because whatever else was happening in the Six, those economies were doing a lot better than we were. And we were talked about the dynamic impact of going into the EEC. So it was seen as a sort of an economic booster, if you like, to Britain. And I supported it.
Right, so there's a couple of plus points in favour of the in people. Aftermath of World War One and Two, and then also in the 70s, we're in such a bad way anyway that, I mean, whatever happened, it could only, the only way was up.
It was seen as a way of changing this country to a more dynamic and modern country. And particularly in Germany, it had done so fantastically well after the Second World War, and it was the great Wunderkind, you know, that had recovered. If I may say so, the 1970s is one long time ago. I mean, you said there are a lot of people here who won't remember 1957. I do, actually. But there are a lot of people here, forgive me, just looking around this studio, who will not remember 1975. And since then, the country has changed out of all recognition. Mrs. Thatcher, she had her pluses, she had her minuses, but she changed this country, and she changed it for the better in terms of economics and markets. And when I worked for the Japanese, they were absolutely staggered how she changed the country for the better. They couldn't get over it. And in the meantime, too, it's not just that we've changed and our attitudes have changed. The world has changed because Europe itself is no longer that dynamic growth area. It is a stagnant area, and the growth markets of the world are clearly elsewhere in the world. So really, Britain needs now to be more global, think globally rather than European.
My other point, though, is taking the marriage analogy. In the 70s, we were going through a rough patch, and we needed the EU.
Weren't married then, or were we married?
We could have been married.
Or just cohabiting.
In the 70s, in the swinging 70s, we needed the EU, or the idea seemed to be, you know, it was a better, they were doing better than us. Now they're not doing so well. Is it fair then just to dump them, you know, through when the times are tough?
I think it's not just that they've changed economically, but they've changed politically, and they've pushed through the political programme, which, of course, as I've said, the Rome Treaty actually promised, although our politicians weren't honest enough to tell us that. But they pushed it through, and since then you've had, you know, not just the Maastricht Treaty, which, of course, set up the political and European Union, but you had the Amsterdam Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty and the Nice Treaty. You've had all these treaties that have changed essentially what the EEC was fundamentally an economic relationship to a political relationship. So under those circumstances, I think it's fair, going through the marriage analogy, that you've seen your spouse change from the sort of cuddly, hands-off, whatever it was, person to somebody who actually interferes with every aspect of your lives. Now, nobody wishes to be suffocated like that. So it's just a different world from the 1970s, and that's why I personally favour.
From my standpoint, as you mentioned, 69 and 70, okay? I was in Vietnam in 69. I came back and graduated from Harvard in 1970. And I will tell you right now, 68, 69 was probably the angriest period ever in the U.S. And one of the things that happened after the war ended, right or wrong, the U.S. became more isolationist, okay? Mm-hmm. Because we'd had Korea, we'd had Vietnam. People said, we have problems in Iowa, we have problems in Minnesota, and if we could have, like Donald Trump, if we could have built a 10-foot wall around the states, we would have. And one of the things where I disagree with the and you mentioned the federal state, okay? When the Federal Reserve was set up in 1913, okay, and we tried the Bank of America before that, and it hadn't worked. Basically, what the Fed did was set up 13 Federal Reserve districts, okay? Now, the Treasury would decide, and Ruth and I remember the old days when interest rates went up and down and up and down, and they were 14, 15, 16%. Now, as we saw in December, the Federal Reserve changed the Fed funds rate, okay? Now, each Fed district has two rates. They have the Fed funds rate, and then they have the local discount rate, okay? For the simple fact is, if Los Angeles is booming, maybe they have a higher discount rate for banks in LA. If Detroit is still having problems, Detroit would have a lower rate. So the simple fact is, the Federal Reserve knew what's happening, okay? And as we see every month or every Fed meeting, they have what they call the beige book. And it's like the agents here, okay? Each FOMC meeting, it may be done by Cleveland or Detroit. So you'll see if all you need to do is go back 15 years ago, San Francisco was dying. San Francisco now, with because of that dot-com boom, it is booming, okay? So the simple fact is, if you get the Federal Reserve District of Cleveland coming out, Cleveland covers Detroit, et cetera, you know that's going to be a depressing, okay, report, where if you get it from the San Francisco Fed, it's going to be San Francisco, L.A., booming. And so this is one of the things where I've always disagreed with the ECB, is because you have a bunch of aristocrats in Brussels or Strasbourg who don't have a clue with what's happening in Slovenia, and
wherever. I was going to say, I think federalism obviously works very well in the States. It works very well in Canada, where the separate colonies came together in 1868. It works very well in Australia, where they came together in 1901. Because apart from anything else, there's a demos.
Yes.
You're American, and you very obviously American, if I may say, and I say that flatteringly.
Thank you.
Because we're not having fisticuffs today. Perhaps another day, but there we go. You talk to Canadians. Canadians are Canadians, defined no doubt by the big brother next door, but Australians are Australians. But when you come to Europe, putting aside whether the Eurozone's working well, which it clearly isn't, there is no demos in Europe.
No.
And it's particularly so in this country that when you do the various barometers, there's Eurobarometer surveys that take place regularly. Do you feel European, or do you feel British, or do you feel Spanish, or do you feel...
Yes.
Then... really, the British are the most sceptical about this. They don't see themselves as European.
It's an interesting point that you made, okay? As you said, I am an American, okay? And who knows how many of 40, 50, 60% of Americans were immigrants. But anywhere you go in the States, I'm an American from Sweden.
Yeah.
I'm an American, I'm Jewish. I'm an American, but I'm an American first.
Exactly.
And where I came from, second. But I am an American first.
And on the ECB, I mean, you brought up this, which I found very interesting, by the way. I didn't realise the states could actually tweak interest rates. I think that's fascinating.
The districts.
The districts. But, of course, as we know, with the ECB, that it's one size fits all. And quite honestly, the trouble is the economies of the Eurozone, which are 19 of them are now, are clearly so disparate that this simply doesn't work. And moreover, back in the 1990s, it was quite obvious that it wouldn't work. But it was the politics that absolutely dominated the decisions to go forward with monetary union with such a large number of countries.
Let's just because there's so many points to this, and we could talk on until the referendum came through.
You mean in 2017?
First point is that, I mean, the EU hasn't worked, let's say, because it's a load of weak economic countries and Germany. So therefore, it's always going to be second rate. The UK didn't come in properly. Switzerland didn't come in. Norway didn't come in. The real cream of Europe hasn't actually come in or been engaged with the EU. So it was just going to be, I won't say losers, but
they're not in.
Yeah, so it's going to be like a second rate type of community. Mm. Part of it's because the UK wasn't properly engaged, Switzerland's not in there, Norway's not in there, et cetera, et cetera. So it's doomed to fail in that way.
I wouldn't say that, because Germany is a very, very powerful economy.
Yes.
And France is not France actually has its difficulties, but it's nothing, you can't just dismiss it. I mean, France and Germany are very sizable economies in themselves, and actually so is Italy, and believe it or not, Spain, having been through some difficulties.
Look how strong Ireland is now.
And Ireland, which of course is a small economy.
All right, so
I don't take that view,
that.
But I think the point is that, you know, the European Union may suit Germany, and I'm a great admirer of Germany, for goodness sake, but going forward, I think the point I made earlier was that you no longer see it as that dynamic growth area that we saw in the 1970s, and partly it's because it's slightly run out of oomph, to use a technical term, rather like Japan, but also because, of course, it's got demographic problems.
Yes.
And Germany's demographics are fascinating to watch, because whatever happens to the current migration situation, putting that on one side, I mean, I have no idea what's going to happen to that. but they have a very low fertility rates and they have a rapidly ageing population. And so, in fact, do the Eastern European countries that were to some extent seen as the great hope of, you know, really geeing up European Union growth. The demographics speak against it. And it's not that I wish to say, Europe, I don't want anything to do with you. I'm all in favour of this country continuing to engage with the European Union. But this country must, if I may say so, we all know that if it comes to growth markets, the growth markets are not in the European Union, no. They're elsewhere.
And a very important point, I work for RZB Austria, okay? I was actually in Leipzig in November of 89, meeting with Wolfgang and Hans and, you know, Jürgen, and all of a sudden we were there because we were going to do a motorized transit system, okay? And all of a sudden the secretary came in, and Wolfgang and Hans all of a sudden left, and she came back about 10 minutes later and said, well, I think they've left. But the point being is that we had done our research knowing that East Germany, okay, this was before the wall came down, okay, yeah, was having a demographic problem then. Then if within 10 years after the wall came down, you probably could not find any 22 to 40-year-old college-educated people that were still in East Germany. That all moved to Berlin, Frankfurt, Cologne, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And hence the reason, this is my feeling, where Angela Merkel and co. were more than willing to bring in, we needed youngsters, whether they had good jobs or not, to help, as you mentioned, the birth problem.
I've no doubt there is an aspect to that, but what they actually will do with 1 million migrants, I wouldn't start to hazard a guess about, because it's very questionable whether a lot of them are employable or not, but that's a slightly different issue. But whatever happens, you're talking about growth markets. The growth markets will not be in Europe.
Right, okay.
But I'd say I don't want to be anti-European. I'm not anti-EU. I just think this country would be better out.
And when let's say it's now July 2016, we voted to get out of the EU. We'll have a crisis in the Tory party. We'll have Boris Johnson laughing.
You mean the Fury part.
Yes, exactly. That's going to be a nightmare. It's just going to be chaos.
I don't think so. I mean, the Conservative Party is extraordinarily capable of reinventing itself on a fairly regular basis. And Cameron has actually said that he will stay on as Prime Minister if they lose the referendum. If he loses,
really,
the
even after 2020 now?
He said it. And I suspect he would. But whatever happens, I think, to me, more interestingly, it's what would happen to the economy. Because, of course, if you have the referendum in June, we vote to leave, then there'll be at least a two-year transition period when you negotiate a new arrangement with the European Union and then finally leave. That's the sort of withdrawal period.
It's a cooling-off period.
It's Article 50.
Do you agree with, I think it's most recently Goldman Sachs, talking about if we agree to Brexit, we're talking cable or dollar sterling mid-130s?
Well, I think that sounds rather a good idea.
I'm sure.
A bit of inflation back in the system. I'm sure Mark Carney would be over the moon.
I mean, we've seen our trade deficit recently. But I think cable, I mean, I don't know where cable will end up. It's actually weakening against the dollar. You know that now, not least of all because the Fed, of course, is putting up interest rates.
I think so. And yet yesterday was not a good. The greenback should have been called the redback. It was a disaster. I mean, cable got up above 145, and I'm sure Mark Carney, I know Super Mario and Mr. Kuroda from Japan, they were going ballistic yesterday. I mean, it was probably, they had a bad hair day, and it was terrible.
Poor darlings.
I'm sure they're weeping into their paychecks, but sorry, that was a very cynical remark to make, wasn't it?
That's what we like here.
Yeah.
But this final question, just so you can be, you have another opportunity to be cynical, Ruth Lee. Mark Carney he's been criticised somewhat for being an unreliable boyfriend and just literally giving people bum steers and not apparently knowing where
maybe
interest rates.
Maybe he'd be governor of Texas then.
Right. Well, that's that.
Bum steers.
Wonderful.
Sorry. Too clever.
With the forward guidance, it's just been a disaster, hasn't it?
It has crumbled like so many things crumble in this world. I think forward guidance was first put forward in, was it August 2013? was it 2013? When he was saying that if unemployment reaches 7%, that that would be a trigger for consideration for putting up interest rates. Well, unemployment now is 5.1%. And, of course, then we've had this iffing and toing. I mean, 12 months ago he was talking about, I think it was last summer he was talking about at the turn of the year, it would become clear as to when we start putting up interest rates. Well, we had his speech recently which said, well, the turn of the year has happened. Some of us had noticed that, by the way. It is 2016. This is another opportunity to be cynical, so I'm being cynical.
Wonderful stuff.
I mean, originally, 18 months ago, he was talking about interest rates going up a year ago last June.
Yes, okay? I mean, it was the Mansion House speech. Yes. I think that was back in 2014.
I mean, if anybody else had said that, who wasn't, you know, this esteemed central banker, you would have just said this person obviously doesn't know what they're talking about, what they're doing.
Oh, no, let's go back.
How come there isn't any, apart from me just saying it now, there isn't any, that's not on the agenda, this man just is not fit for the job?
Well, I wouldn't be quite as bold as that, but I think the message of this story is you've got to be very, very careful when you give indications to the markets, because I don't work in the markets anymore, but I did when I worked for Mitsubishi Bank, and believe it's not Lehman Brothers. And you know that they hang on every single word of what Janet Yellen will say, or what Mark Carney will say, or what Mario Draghi will say, because that's what markets do. And so I think, if I may say so, he should be, if I may, more careful.
Ruth, classic example. As we know, that the head of the Federal Reserve has to go before the House and Senate Committee to get their funding every year. And this goes back to probably 1992 or 93, okay? And Alan Greenspan was hearing before the Senate Committee. One of the senators asked him a question, and Mr. Greenspan's comment was, "Sir, if you understood what I said, you definitely were not listening." And I think that's what these central banks need to do.
It's okay. Appropriate to you now, isn't it, Bill, really, possibly?
Steady on, Zach, now. I thought you were going to be nice.
I think Carney should take heed.
Exactly right.
Right, I'm sitting here with Bill Hubar, Chief Economist of Bullion Capital, and Zaf Karim, CEO of Legendary Investments. Gentlemen, quite a turbulent time in the stock market.
How can you say that? I've never had so much fun.
The worst start to the year ever in some cases. And then I think even worse is that, you know, these big names coming up almost on a daily basis, you know, Shell, BP, Credit Suisse, et cetera, with massive losses. And they seem to be sort of caught by surprise and caught off guard.
Not really. I mean, look at BP. Their job is oil, okay? I mean, remember, I'm sure we've heard the terms interest rate swaps, okay? Buy front month, sell 6 months, okay? You do it in dollars. Then you do this. You do another swap in dollars to yen or yen to Swedish krona. So the problem is, yes, we can say that the spot market is down. But these people, I mean, we're talking about incredible hedges. And as I was mentioning before, in July of 2008, when we almost got to $150 a barrel, okay, the two biggest sellers the next week were, I won't give you the names, but they were BP and BA. And they're like, their average cost of some of the oil they were selling was in the mid-70s to low-80s, okay? Selling it up, they were doing futures to spot, okay?
Well, isn't the obvious answer to that the hedges and all these derivatives are actually worse, the cure is worse than the disease? I mean, you lose more, you're locked into losing a lot of money if the market goes the wrong way.
Yeah, but I mean, Jeff, you know this. No. I mean, you know, when I started in the market and I worked for numbers, you know, the simple fact is when businesses were first set up, you have the accountant. You have your assets and your liabilities, okay? And I remember when I was at one, I won't give you the institution, the accountant said, well, what is this 14 years ahead? Well, that's a swap we've done. And when I was with ICAP, I remember trying to do a swap. The swap was brilliant, but we did it in Danish government bonds, okay? Barclays was our clearer. It was only 100 million, but it took us 6.5 days to find enough bonds to accumulate to do the swap, which both sides said, please do it, because the swap was hugely profitable.
That's fine. That's probably what the CEOs would say. But I would at least say that we know that, for instance, BHP Billiton expanded into the shale boom right at the top. Big companies are like all tankers, literally. They buy everything and they merge and they buy and they acquire at the top, and they're selling at the bottom and cutting jobs at the other end of the spectrum. So it becomes You know, and we're seeing that now. The buy at the top, sack people at the bottom. And, you know, it's...
But it doesn't
matter because they're so big and the shareholders will bail them out, etc.
I think that's a little unfair on large companies. You know, the first thing which Bill has already mentioned is companies hedge months, if not years, in advance. Airlines do it. All fuel users do it, and indeed the fuel suppliers do it, because if they didn't do it, they'd have the daily volatility and they would not be able to. They're not trading houses, they have trading units, but they have to look at the underlying business, which needs regular cash flows, needs regular expenses paid, and that's why they hedge.
See, as I said, you could do this on the spot market, and you know you trade in futures. You have limit up or limit down.
Of course.
It's just whether you trade in iron ore or whether you trade in pork bellies, okay? All of a sudden, if there were too many buyers or too many sellers, the market doesn't open that day, okay?
Correct.
And my feeling is, you know, ever since this move up in gold, if this really was a safe haven play, gold would be $2,000-$4,000, not up 35. To me, that's been a margin call trade, and it's only done better recently because of the dollar. Because if everybody was getting clobbered by being margin call on every stock from A to Z, what were they doing? They were selling their gold. They didn't care whether they'd only make a couple of bucks, but they had a profit in gold, even if it was a couple of dollars versus tens of thousands of book losses, not real losses, on some of their equity positions.
The second thing is, if you put aside the financial instruments, the hedges, etc., you know, if you have an oil field or gas field and it's fully functioning and operational, it actually costs hundreds of millions of dollars to start to reduce the production and to shut it down. And the choices now being made are that, okay, some of these less economic ones, we're going to shut them down. But you can't just turn the tap off. It actually costs a lot of money to shut them down. So that also contributes to the losses. So what's happening is the companies are repositioning themselves for a environment where, you know, it depends on who you talk to. Midterm oil is going to be, is it going to be 60, 70, 80? Nobody's saying it's going to be 100 again in the, you know, midterm, maybe long term, who knows what's going to happen. But they have to reposition themselves. And if they keep all the uneconomic stuff open, they won't be able to reposition themselves. But there's a cost to doing that. So there's the financial aspect, the hedging, and there's the operational aspect.
And you have to.
So, you know, asleep at the wheel, I do think that's a bit harsh.
Because for years, I had clients that were both in Dallas and Houston, okay? I remember 78, 79, okay? And as you said, whether it be an oil field or a steel mill, you don't just turn it off and then get 6 million degrees at a steel mill by turning it on the next day. It takes, but this is the difference with the shale people. This is very easy. They can say, thank you very much. Or where are they going? They're staying at the Premier or Motel 6, okay? And you even see BlackRock and two other hedge funds saying, if they get cheap enough, we'll buy them as distressed companies, okay? We'll buy them from the banks, okay? And the simple fact is it will come back. But as you said, it's not a question of the consumption. We're looking at, I think it goes back to when Drake first discovered oil in 1849. I mean, I think there's more oil now than there was then, okay? And even Russia finally admitted they have the highest post-Soviet Union reserve. And what are they going to do? They still got to keep pumping because that's, what, 70% of their GDP.
Yeah.
Right, so they aren't going to stop.
Going from the resources area to the banking sector, as I said, the Credit Suisse just announced a massive loss as well. How are they losing money when they've got, well, you know, we bailed most of them out. The governments have tipped everything in favor of the banks, you know, zero rates, et cetera, et cetera. How are they still, you know, just going into a downward spiral? The share prices this year of Barclays, RBS, we've had the another fiasco for George Osborne with the pulling the Lloyds Bank share sale, where we're going to buy shares we already own or buy them, or he's selling them to us, or he's already sold them higher and he's going to, I mean, whatever they're doing there. So total mess on that front. And there's job losses there at Lloyds too. That's a fiasco, isn't it?
But one of the things you're looking at, right, let's look at a Morgan Stanley, a Credit Suisse, a Deutsche Bank, and a Goldman Sachs. They make how much of their money in bond trading?
Yeah.
And there is no bond trading. People have just bought bonds. As I was mentioning earlier today, the best trade so far in 2016 is who have bought the five-year treasury. You've made 5.2%, okay, since the 1st of January. Yesterday, the five-year bond traded at minus 0.5%. So the simple fact is everybody is buying bonds. Not trading bonds, buying bonds. What does that mean? You've got one trade. So you do a trade today at Credit Suisse. You may not do another trade with that client till, who knows, when the Fed starts raising rates in December. And so there's no liquidity. That is the problem. And most of these trades are set up on swaps. If you look at this, the swaps market is dead. The only thing that saved these companies were IPOs.
So that's all, so basically, is the explanation for that, the overregulation and the whole change?
Yes, it's regulation.
So the regulators the
root
have
of it
the
is regulation.
Kill the market, okay?
Basically, what's happened is, you know, during the noughties, with both OUGH and AUGH, things, let's say, got too exuberant, and for you know a whole variety of reasons, and post 2008. The regulators have slammed on the brakes. And if you look at this historically, you know, you can go back as far back as 1929, 1933, etc.
Even I wasn't born yet.
What happens is the regulatory pendulum swings one way and the other way. And in the noughties, the regulatory pendulum was quite loose. And now it's swung far the other way. And so, you know, you've got the banks being attacked from a number of perspectives. One, their capital ratios are being increased and being changed, which makes it more difficult for them to make money. Secondly, in terms of the activities they can pursue, that's being changed. Glass-Steagall was effectively dismantled in the late 90s, and now it's essentially being put back into place. That's the separation of investment banking and deposit-taking banking.
My father went to University of Virginia with E. Carter Glass. So.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got the regulatory pendulum swinging, you know, to the extent that it's clamping down on business. That's one thing. The bond thing is absolutely another thing. And now we are looking at an environment where it's possible we'll get negative interest rates. Mm. Look at Japan, right? Then the third thing is, again, these banks have large cost bases. And because of a different type of regulation, labor regulation, you can't just fire people. You've got to give them redundancy payments, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a structural shift going on, which is going to cause losses. I think it's harsh to say people have been asleep at the wheel. The upside of this is, in these turbulent times, there are always opportunities. Now, it takes a brave man to jump in. It takes a brave man to jump in. But if you jump in and you jump into the right ones, and you have the staying power to last, you can make fortunes. Warren Buffett said this. Right. Nathan Rothschild said this.
Right.
You know, 300 years earlier.
How many people do you know, when we had that slight problem with the housing market in 1989, and I actually bought a house, an auction, okay, in Suffolk. Everybody said I was the biggest idiot in the world, right? Well, when I sell it, you know, my accountant's going to say, well done. But we can always look back and say, God, and it goes back. My first day of trading at the Morgan Guaranty in 1971, okay, big John Griffo puts his hand around me. I said, Bill, it's something I want to tell you. I only wish for one thing. I was thinking, oh, John, don't tell me you're one of those guys. But he said, right now, 7 o'clock Monday morning, I only wish for one thing. I want to see right now tomorrow's FT. I'll be the best trader in the world. Okay.
So, Zaf, you're CEO of Legendary Investments. Can you just tell us what you think is the best, what are the best opportunities are at the moment?
Look, I think in the current environment, if you are brave and you have staying power, I think now is the time to start thinking about being a contrarian and actually getting into things like commodities, actually getting into things like ONG, resources.
Directly or through an ETP or ETF?
It depends. I think if you have the capacity to do it directly, then go direct. Right, but if you don't have that expertise or capacity, then go through an exchange traded fund, or you know you could even play the leverage play and go into some of the companies that are involved in these, because essentially all the oil and gas companies and mining companies leverage plays on the underlying commodities. Now you'd have to be brave, because a lot of people will tell you, like they told you, Bill, you know, you're an idiot buying a house in 1989. You're an idiot buying a gold mine now, but you know things are changing. Oil, so it went down to 25 or 26, and now it's back up to the 30s. You know, the things are going to change, because the actions the large players are taking, mean that capacity is getting constrained.
And that's the key thing that's said, okay? Why is Anglo-American, why it's be, they've cut in their dividends. They're cutting, it's like anywhere else. You either go too high or too low. Correct. Right now, they're going too low. You know as well as I do, why are there always jobs in the city? Because when it gets bad, everybody gets hired and fired, okay? Yeah. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. Now, it may not be this week, it may not be next week, but the simple fact is, are you a speculator? Or the question I presume you're asking, are you an investor?
Yeah. If you're a speculator, short staying power, it may not be a good thing. But if you're an investor, this could be a pretty good opportunity. It might take 5 years. I don't know. But, you know, world economy is going to continue to grow. It's not going to shrink. These things are going to continue to be used. And the fact is, over the last couple of years, there's too much supply. And China's moving to a consumer economy, et cetera, et cetera. We all know that argument. But the fact is, the actions being taken are now constraining demand, and demand in these areas is inelastic.
That's right. With thanks to Ruth Lee, Bill Hubbard, and Zaf Karim, this has been The Collection. I'm Zach Meir.